final case this morning is Link Equipment against Signal Medical Services. Mr. Darcy.
Good morning. Alex Darcy again for Link Equipment Services. This case comes on appeal, a trial court decision at trial regarding whether a plaintiff in a breach of contract action for a breach of an equipment lease needs to prove that
Mr.
the parties...
Darcy, I'm worried about federal subject matter jurisdiction. Do we have any?
We have supplemental jurisdiction under 1367C, Your Honor.
Now, why?
Because originally, Your Honor, the case was brought and removed to federal court under the Carmack Amendment, Your Honor. And that gave
provided, I'm perfectly willing to assume that there was jurisdiction over the claim against the motor carrier.
That's correct.
But supplemental jurisdiction depends on the claim against the other party being part of the same case or controversy as the claim within federal jurisdiction. That's how one can get pendant party jurisdiction under 1367. And how is this claim part of the same case or controversy as the claim against the motor carrier?
Well, Your Honor, our original claim against the motor carrier was for both, our claim against the motor carrier was for the same types of damages that we were trying to recover in this case.
Doesn't make something the same case or controversy.
Well, I think the theory, Your Honor, was that they, by breaching their carriage contract, Your Honor, they were liable for the lost rental income. And similarly, by breaching the lease related to the same
breaching
equipment.
Breaching a lease and breaching a contract of motor carriage, one would think of as almost definitionally not part of the same case or controversy.
Right. But the connection, Your Honor, is that the breach resulted from the damage to the equipment, and the equipment was the same in each instance.
That's not what the statute says. The statute doesn't say producing similar damage. And the magic words in the statute are part of the same case or controversy. Now, what that would normally mean, the normal implication of that, is that if it's not brought within the same suit, it's barred by res judicata. That's why that's there in 1367, so that everything that would be covered by a doctrine of preclusion can be brought in together. Is this claim something that would be governed by a doctrine of preclusion if not litigated in the same court at the same time?
I don't believe it would, Your Honor.
No, it transparently would not. It's completely different. I think we've got a serious question whether there is jurisdiction under the supplemental jurisdiction statute.
Well, I've been in front of you, believe it or not, Your Honor. Actually, I wrote a brief. I wasn't in front of you, but I wrote the brief in Stromberg Metalworks.
Yes.
In that case, you allowed supplemental jurisdiction.
After permitted. First exercising particular care to ensure that it was part of the same case or controversy.
Well, permissive joinder.
One contract with two different parties. Here, we've got completely different contracts, the lease contract and the carriage contract, with different parties.
Actually, I thought there were two separate contracts in that case, Your Honor, to be truthful, but the project was the same. It was one nuclear power plant in Maryland, I believe, is what they were fighting over.
Mm-hmm.
And the claim against the party who was allowed to join, that we were allowed to join as a defendant.
Well, maybe this is something that you haven't given it detailed thought. Maybe this is something that the two of you should prepare and file supplemental briefs on.
Fair enough.
We'll give you 10 days to brief the question whether this is part of the same case or controversy for purposes of 1367.
Okay. Should we continue with the damages portion of the argument, Your Honor?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think, Your Honor, first, there seems to be a dispute as to what the district court actually ruled. And I think the Signal is taking the position that the court used an objective standard, that under an objective standard, the parties did not contemplate damages for lost income in this case. And I would obviously disagree. I think the court makes it clear in the second paragraph of its analysis on page 2 of its opinion that it's looking for evidence that the parties expressly contemplated evidence of lost profits. And I think its view is reaffirmed in the last page of its opinion, where it says that there's no evidence that the parties knew, using the word knew as in knowledge, actual knowledge, that Cigna would be liable for Link's lost rental income.
But let me ask you another question that it's not covered directly in your brief, but I'm having trouble understanding why the parties are going back and forth about $30,000 a month and the like. Why isn't the measure of damages in this case, if expectation damages are available, the measure of cover, standard UCC measure? There's more than one MRI machine in the world. If one machine is damaged or broken, you ask what you could buy another one for. And that will reflect, of course, that will be based on anticipation about the long-term income stream from these machines. But that will just be rolled into the cost of the machine. So you would look at the difference between the value of the machine as returned and the cost of cover, of buying another machine of equivalent age, but in good condition.
Well, I think the number will get you to the same. I think our point, Your Honor, was that we...
My bet is that these figures would differ by a lot more than $350,000, or rather by a lot less than $350,000. The parties don't seem to have addressed this question.
I follow you. I mean, you presuppose that we would go out on the market, either rent or lease another MRI for the period of time during the period of repair, and then subsequently lease that to our customers. I'm sorry?
Right. If somebody has your chattel and breaks it,
right,
they've got a machine that is worth $500,000 and they break it and they return it in a condition that requires $150,000 of repairs, I mean, presumably what you can go out and buy another machine for $500,000. If you had profitable leasing customers, you would lease that machine. And then after this machine is repaired, you would sell it in the secondhand market. Right? Your damage is the difference between that cost and the repair cost. Or I can just put it another way. You have a duty to minimize your damages. If they return your machine in bad condition, one doesn't say, oh, I'm sorry, we can't rent our machines, so we're now on their dime for $33,000 a month, making no effort to obtain another machine to use in its place. The idea of cover in the Uniform Commercial Code is based on the concept of mitigating one's damages.
So that's just
another way to put this question.
I understand your point, Your Honor, but I think the other point in this context, if you take your plaintiffs as you find them, they knew that we were in this business and wanted to imagine this position. They had broken the machine and they had just chosen to repair it themselves. They would presumably be liable for the rent during the period of repair until they returned it, because that's what the terms of the contract provided.
Not clear. That's the detention of the chattel, but whether they're liable for the rent would depend in part on whether you had a profitable use had it been returned.
No, I'm saying if they hadn't returned, if they had discovered the damage while they had possession of it and had sent it for repair on their own, no knowledge to us, right, the rental contract would have continued and they would have paid rent as they normally would have until it was repaired.
They
won't pay rent because it's broken.
What if you had four of the machines just like it, and they weren't in demand?
Well, they weren't in demand.
Pardon?
Well, I think our position is that we're a bulk seller, Your Honor, and that we've lost an opportunity by having this damage the way it is.
But your conduct doesn't verify that position. If there was a customer who would rent a machine like this for $33,000 a month, and if, as the sale value of this machine, $475,000 is what you got for it after it's repaired, suggests there's a secondhand market where machines of this sort can be bought for $475,000. Well, you just put it together. What period of rental would generate the present value of $475,000? It's about 18 months.
Fair enough.
Right? So your client was not behaving in a way that suggested that we had a long-term customer willing to pay $33,000 a month. Because if so, your client would have gone out, bought another one of these machines for $475,000, and rented it.
Well, I think you're making a couple of assumptions, Your Honor. One, you're assuming that we have $500,000 to go out and buy another machine.
I don't care whether you've got $500,000 or 500,000 pennies. If there's money to be made, you can find a lender who will make a loan.
I think you're assuming a whole slew of facts, Your Honor. I mean, I understand your line of inquiry and why you're concerned that maybe you think we didn't act as rationally as we did, but I think, you know, part of the problem...
My point is, I'm assuming your client acted perfectly rationally. But your client's rational action suggests that the damages theory being advanced in this case is not a good one. You can answer it.
Oh, no. Okay.
Well, those are a lot of defenses that are available to your opponent to argue if you're successful in convincing us that you're entitled to any.
You're pointing me in the right direction, which I would argue to the court that the defendants did not argue that. They did fight us tooth and nail on what the fair market value rental would be, and I think one of the conclusions, if you somehow conclude that the court did use the right legal standard and were inclined to rule under the clearly erroneous standard, I think you would find that we proved some damages. But their point in their testimony wasn't that the MRI had no value. It just had less value than what we said.
If you're right here and we reverse, they don't have to write a check for all these rentals that you lost. They have a lot of defenses they can make to it.
I understand. So reserve those.
Thank you, Mr. Darcy. Michaelides.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Barbara Michaelides from Clark & Miller on behalf of the defendant. I am not prepared to discuss the supplemental jurisdiction issue, but will submit a brief in 10 days. Moving on to the merits, I think Your Honors have seized upon one of the critical failings in this case. One, this lease is governed by the UCC, and the UCC does not provide for consequential damages in the event of a lessee's breach. But on the facts, the conduct of the plaintiff belies their claim here because the testimony that was taken establishes that there were, in fact, no contracts to lease this MRI upon its return after a brief six-month period of time. There were other MRIs off-lease available for either lease or sale during the identical period of time that did not get moved, and in fact, plaintiff's representative testified that Link was in the process of getting out of the leasing business and was really trying to sell the MRI, and in fact began negotiation for the sale of the MRI well before it was repaired, and in fact did sell the MRI machine after it was repaired.
Does the record show what the expected life of this machine was?
The record does not show.
We could go backward from knowing a $475,000 purchase price and the expected economic productive life to figuring out what the net gain per month was, because you can construe that, you can understand it as just buying an annuity.
I think the record shows, in a rough sense, that MRIs have a useful life. I think it depends on the testimony trial indicated that it depends on the manufacturer, the strength of the magnet, and the age of the machine. I believe the parties agreed that at some point in time, which was not defined, that MRI machines become obsolete, and that would, of course, be the end of their useful life. But fixing that past that point was not done below. This machine was manufactured in 92, and so at the time that we're discussing, it was already nearly 5 years old, but outside of the testimony that they become obsolete over time, there was no testimony that would fix when that would actually occur. Um, I think we also have to keep in mind here the standard is whether or not the court's findings were clearly erroneous on the facts. Certainly the court heard the evidence, the testimony of the representatives, and found that there just was no evidence to support the plaintiff's claim that any of the parties reasonably expected this MRI would be available and immediately released upon its return after a brief 6-month period of time in the used MRI market, which I believe the parties conceded was competitive and did not hold any guarantees of future income, and certainly did not hold a guarantee of $400,000 of future income. And unless the court has any further questions, we'll leave it at that, and we'll submit a brief on the jurisdictional question.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. The court will be in recess until tomorrow.